Good morning. Okay, we're going to start. Thank you for coming. And we're just going to move ahead with our next, our main heading, which is what I call Menschlichkeit. It's basically, how do we raise our children to be functional human beings, being able to conduct themselves in a healthy, wholesome manner in the world. So we should really step back for a minute and just appreciate the fact that human beings are the pinnacle of creation, and should just appreciate what it means to give birth, to nurture, to develop a human being. That's the role of a parent, and that is an incredible. You know, we're partners with Hashem. It's not just in the creation of the child, but in the development, the nurturing, everything that the child is and becomes. That's what we're involved with. So we're working for the highest cause possible. What does a human being need? A human being needs a lot of things. One thing that we need to be aware of is the warm, loving, and supportive environment from birth. That's what a child needs. That's our job to provide that. We have a concept of an emotional bank account, which I think we've mentioned in the past, that a child, and really any person, they need deposits of positive emotion into their, what we'll call their bank account, their emotional bank account. And that's something that we have to do on a constant basis, because we're going to have to be making withdrawals when we reprimand our children, when we deny something from them, when something bad happens, or we can't do something that they want us to do. These are all withdrawals from their bank account. So what part of the nurturing process and the warmth is to constantly try to build up that reservoir of good feeling, of love and support for them. We really have to be there for our children. This week's Parsha, the Torah tells us that Moshe grew up and he went out to see his brothers, the Bnei Yisrael, went from the palace where he was growing up, went to see them, and he looked at their burdens, at their difficulties. And Rashi says that what he was doing was, he said, he uses the words, I'll say in English, he said he set his eyes and heart to feel pain for them. And the Gur Aryeh, the Maharal, points out, said, how does Rashi know that Moshe was like to that extent that he put his whole being into feeling their pain? And he said that he was already an adult, Moshe Rabbeinu, so obviously he was aware of what was going on. So the pasuk tells us that he went to see Vayar, that he saw what was this. We can see with a quick glance, so you can see something with great depth, you can see something with great understanding. So what he was seeing was he was really trying to understand what was going on. He was really trying to feel, their pain. He was making an extra effort to see deeply into what they were experiencing. Like we mentioned last time that I can feel for myself, or I can, feel for you. I can't do both at the same time. So this is what Moshe Rabbeinu was doing. And this was the leadership quality that we saw in him. That he put himself into the feelings of the Bnei Yisrael. That was what he did. And that was how he was able to really gain a deeper understanding of what they were doing. And as parents, it's extremely, extremely important for us to really try to understand things from a child's perspective, to really, really not just hear what the kid has to say and then, and that's terrible, and move on. And we learn this from Moshe Rabbeinu. that to really be able to understand somebody, you have to work at it. And to be able to help somebody, you have to understand them. I want to read something that actually came from Stephen Covey in The Seven Habits of Highly Effective Families, which was a recounting of an incident in the life of one of his children. It sounds like it was written by the child after she was already an adult, reflecting back on her experience and what you felt and how her parents helped her through the situation. So I'm going to read it because that's really give you an insight into how it can make a difference in our children's development. So her name is Cynthia. When I was 5 years old, my parents moved to Belfast, Ireland for 3 years. I picked up on my playmate's Irish accent, and when I returned to third grade, I had a strong Irish brogue. Because I had lived in Ireland, I had learned to play American games, such as kick the can, baseball, capture the flag, jump rope rhymes, and I felt very out of it. I could sense the kids in my class thought I was different, because they couldn't understand me, and I didn't know how to play any of the games they had been playing for years. My teacher stuck me in speech therapy to get rid of my accent, and tried to help me catch up academically because I lagged far behind. I was having trouble, especially in math. I was afraid to admit that I didn't know some of the basics. I didn't want to stand out anymore, and I longed to be accepted and have friends. Instead of asking for help in math, I discovered that all the answers to our worksheets were on cards in the back of the room. I began sneaking those cards out and then copying the answers without being caught. It seemed for a time all my problems were solved. In my heart, I knew it was wrong, but it seemed to me the end justified the means. I began getting attention from the teacher and other students for doing so well. In fact, I was presented as the model student who worked hard, finished my work quickly, and consistently scored the highest in the class. It was wonderful for a while because I was popular and a lot of kids liked me. But my conscience kept after me because I knew I had betrayed myself and what my parents had always taught me about honesty. I wanted to stop. I was so ashamed of cheating. But now I was in a trap and I didn't know how to get out of it without totally humiliating myself. I had to keep cheating because the teacher expected me to do well every time now. I was miserable and the problem seemed insurmountable to an 8-year-old with no way out. I knew I should tell my parents what was happening, but I was too embarrassed because I was the oldest. I began acting out at home, losing my temper easily because of the pressure of dealing with this problem alone. My parents told me later that they could sense something was very wrong in my life, but they didn't have what it was. In Ireland, we, the family, had started the practice of having private interviews with a parent once a month. This was a time when we could talk about anything we wanted, complain about home duties or unfairness shown, talk about our friends or anything that interested us, give ideas for activities, share problems or whatever. The rule was that mom or dad could only listen, not talk or criticize or give advice or suggestions without being invited to. We all looked forward to our private interviews. During one of these interviews, my dad let me go off about some injustice I felt my parents dealt me without defending himself or getting angry. He could sense that wasn't the real problem, he just let me talk. Finally, when I felt accepted and not condemned, I cautiously started to open up a little to sense his reaction. He asked if things were going well in school and if I was happy there. Defensively, I blurted out, "If you only knew, you'd think I was terrible. I can't tell you about it." For a few minutes, he affirmed his unconditional love and acceptance of me, and I felt his sincerity. I had opened up on other occasions about things without rebuke. And so I felt I could trust him with the awful truth. Suddenly it just blurted for me and I found myself crying and yelling, "I'm cheating in math!" Then I fell into his arms. It was such a relief to get it out, even though I couldn't see a solution and feared the consequences. I had shared my terrible secret with my father, and I still felt his love and support of me in spite of it. I remember him saying, "Oh, how awful for you to have had this inside you for so long. I wish you had told me so I could have helped you." He asked if he could call my mother into the room, and then I told them the whole story. I saw no way out, but amazingly enough, they helped me work out a solution that would not totally humiliate me. We would go together to the teacher, I would get a sixth grader to help me with my math. They affirmed me and understood what happened, and to this day, I can still feel the relief of that moment. Who knows what pattern I would have established in my life and what road I would have taken if I had continued in my dishonesty. But I was able to share my problem with parents who had already established a relationship of trust and a track record of consistent love and encouragement. They had made such huge deposits over the years that my large withdrawal did not leave me totally bankrupt. Instead, that day, I collected interest. That's her story. And the father said, I'll read what he said. "I often think back to that experience and I wonder what would have happened if I had been so busy, so rushed, so anxious to get to an appointment or to get on to something more important that I didn't take the time to really listen. What more would that daughter have gone through? What different choices might she have made?" And I just point out, this was all before the days of cell phones and smartphones. So people were distracted. Before then, we have a bigger challenge, obviously. But this one-to-one time that they had with their daughter, she said it was once a month. Okay, but this is a time for, the kid could say anything, fetching, moaning, complaining, could complain about the parents. Just listen, and if they want some advice, they want your comments, so that's fine. But if they don't ask for it, you're just listening. Showing your compassion. It's a tremendously powerful tool of trying to understand and get into how the child is perceiving things. And this is a very abject lesson here of how, chances are the child would have formed patterns of behavior if it had not been stopped that would have been potentially extremely destructive, throughout her life. It wasn't just a third grade thing. It was her essential character. Yes.
What if the child is speaking in a disrespectful way to the parents?
Okay, so what if they're speaking disrespectfully? I think that you can let them go on. At the end of the session, maybe when you calm down a drop, you can sort of like review and say in the future, we want to hear what you have to say. Maybe you could, maybe we can work on that, a better way to say it. But many times, also, if you know the child, what sounds like disrespect is not meant to be disrespectful. They're venting, they're frustrated, they let it out on you. Obviously, refining their speech. I was struck by it. I saw a clip a couple of days ago about somebody who had a wonderful surprise for their child, like a wonderful, unexpected, hoped for, but the child didn't really expect to get it. And I was just struck because the child kept saying to the parent, you're lying, it can't be, you're lying. So if it was my child, I would hope that my child would say, you're kidding, you're teasing, not you're lying. Like, where did that come from, that the child felt comfortable to be able to say to a parent that they're lying? So, I'm just saying, it sounds like the kind of verbiage that goes on between the child and parent, that the child feels comfortable saying, or that's like the instinctive reaction of the child to the parent, that, oh, you're lying. A child should never think that a parent lies and should, they're teasing them, they're kidding, they're making a joke. Lying is a little bit strong for trying to have that, for that kind of an interchange. So just, I guess I'm expanding on your question. In general, we have to be very careful about the kind of words that we let our children, say to us, even if they're frustrated, which is a different point. That's not how we talk to mommy. Yeah, very calmly, that's not how we talk to mommy. Okay, let's say that a better way. know, they're not changing, the message, but you're training them to, speak more respectfully.
Thank you.
If the kid during that session, let's say I start the session this once a month, if like I said, it's speaking disrespectfully, is it better to do it like right after the session, or rather like maybe like a day or two later? Like, shouldn't that session be?
You might be right. Try it and try it either way.
The kid might take it the wrong right. way, like that you weren't open enough.
Yeah. You might be right. Right. Interesting point. I'm not sure. It's
like
hard to
correct the verbiage,
Right. Yeah. Sometimes when you wait a while, so then
maybe
the kid is saying like, "Oh, this is all my parent got out of the session." You know, I was thinking about, you know,
But they do it again, because obviously they're going to say it then. They probably will talk to you again. So then you can say it there, but not in that specific session where you're supposed to be
right.
listening. No,
right, could be. I mean, you could also possibly. I'm not sure. You probably know better than me. Did you have a question?
So I don't know. Maybe when the child is little, they say you're lying, but they really don't understand the word lie as we understand it as adults. Like the dimension we give to lie, we don't lie. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, whatever. It's like another word in their language.
It could be. But it's a sensitivity. You know, to me, it would like be a little bit jarring. You know, if a child told me like you're lying. Yeah. I don't know, but it depends. It also depends on the age. I mean, this particular the child was a little bit older, upper elementary age. So, okay, all right. So that's trying to understand the child. That's my first one. B, integrity. Okay, integrity. Integrity is essential to humanity. We're able to relate to people if they have integrity. We try to develop that in our children. And I guess following up on this, on somebody being dishonest, it would be helpful to understand why a child or anybody would be, one potential reason why a person would be dishonest. And it's fascinating. There's fascinating research. It's already over 50 years ago, in the area of cognitive dissonance. Probably all heard the term and never remember what it means. Like, I always have to remind myself, what is that? But this was the experiment that they did. It was on a college campus, and the professor had a number of subjects, divided them into two different groups. They went into a room one at a time. They didn't know anybody else, but they were involved in this experiment, and he sat them in a room, and this was way before technology, probably television had just been invented. So he sat them in a room, and they beamed a beam of light on the wall for about 45 minutes. That was the experiment. Nothing else happened. The subject sat there one at a time in this room, watched this thing go out. That was the experiment. Okay, so. When they came out of the room, they divided them into two groups. They said, people know that you're in this experiment. So they gave half of them, they said they're going to ask you, was it an interesting experiment? So it was a total bore. So it was an interesting experiment. So half of them, they gave them $1 and said, if anybody asks you, tell them, it was really interesting. That was half of them. Then the other half, they gave him $20, which was a long time ago, gave him $20 and said the same thing. If anybody asks you, is this interesting, tell him, it was really interesting. So as far as any of the subjects knew, that was the end of the experiment. What the professor did was he arranged that about a month later, so each one of the subjects, somebody accidentally bumped into them on campus and said, hey, weren't you in Professor so-and-so's experiment? So they said, yeah, I was. Tell me, was it interesting? So the results of that question were that almost 50% said it was really interesting, and 50% said it was a total bore. the Chiddush, what was most startling, and this was the point of his experiment, was that the 50% who said that it was really interesting were the group that got $1, not the group that got the $20. So the explanation that he gave, and this was one of the, pioneers in this area of what we know as cognitive dissonance, he said that a person cannot live with a contradiction in their own behavior. So the ones who got $20, okay, I told a lie, I said it was interesting. Hey, but for $20, it's worth it. The ones who had only got $1, they could not justify in their own mind, why would I lie for one measly dollar? So they convinced themselves that it was really interesting. Again, I'll explain. But the people who had no justification for doing something wrong, in this case lying, so they ended up convincing themselves that it really wasn't a lie. Like it was really okay what I did. And I don't have a conscience about it because somehow in their mind they were able to change the reality into having been something interesting. As opposed to the people who got a lot of money for it, so didn't bother their conscience. And they said, yeah, it was a total bore, but hey, I don't care that I told people that it initially told them it was interesting because it was worth it. So extrapolating that to our behavior in everyday life, so many things that we do that are somewhat questionable and maybe bother our conscience a little bit, so we have this need to not have our conscience bother us. So we end up justifying in our own mind many things that we do. So with the children, it's certainly true that they'll do something and they'll convince themselves that that it was appropriate behavior. And this all takes place subconsciously, but nobody's aware of it, but this is what happens. So this whole concept of cognitive dissonance is that when a person's behavior doesn't match their value level, so then they either change their values or they convince themselves that what they did was in alignment with their values. Just to give an example, one of the most effective means of getting somebody to become a Baal Tshuva is for them to start doing mitzvahs, for them to start keeping Shabbos, or being involved in Shabbos. So you have a person who feels like they're part of the modern day world. They're cool. They're hip. They have all these what they to them is normal friends, and now they're doing this crazy thing. They're like putting their phones away for Shabbos. They're not driving. What's going on with me? So one of two things will happen. Either they'll say, this is crazy, I'm out of here, or they'll begin to convince themselves that, hey, this is really like a valuable thing that I'm doing, and they will. So their actions will end up changing their beliefs. And I mean, Chazal tell us, Sefer Achinuch says, Adam Nifal Kpi Losa. The person will begin to act based upon how he's actually acting. So if you want to change a behavior, get the person to change the behavior. And then they'll convince themselves, I'm still normal by acting this way. So in many areas of a child's behavior, they're constantly trying to figure themselves out. Like, am I this kind of person, that kind of person? Like in the story that we saw before, like she was, on the brink of convincing herself that now she was First, she was a incompetent student. Then she convinced herself she was a competent student because she was performing well, albeit through nefarious methods. Then she convinced herself that she was a dishonest person. And all of that going back and forth was based upon her behavior. So with a child, we have to, number one, understand that they are many times, they don't know how to get out of a situation. They did something, so they either, they deny it or they really begin to feel that it was something, it was an okay thing. So we always have to be sensitive and aware of that kind of behavior, that kind of a reaction on the part of the child to be able to understand where they're coming from. To start calling them, you know, you're a liar, or you're dishonest, or you have no integrity. Those things will, just like the behavior, will start to change the attitude. So when they hear those words from the most powerful and important people in the world, their parents, that will certainly begin to change them. So if we're trying to get a child to be a person of integrity, okay, so we have to help them to be able to act in an appropriate manner, and to be sensitive to the fact that many times what they might be saying is not really what they believe. They're just trying to justify what something that they did, which could be completely hidden from us. So obviously integrity is all the other things, role modeling, as we've mentioned. They see a parent, they see us concerned about doing things honestly. But I'm just focusing on this point that many times you'll think a child is doing something dishonest. Many times we have first graders, second graders, they're taking other people's things. It could be because they don't understand the concept of possession. You have to teach a child that there's such a concept as possession before they can really know what's mine and what's yours. But many times they're just they're impulsive, and then they have to just cover up for their impulsivity, and they begin a pattern of both behavior and of talk that is not where they were before. But if we don't catch it, it could end up being something that gets more deeply ingrained in them. So we have to be very careful. Okay, moving on to training a child for independence. Okay, our goal in life is for children to be able to function successfully after we're gone. Okay, hopefully that's many, many years down the road, but that is our goal. We don't want them to be dependent upon us, and we have to be very careful that we don't make them dependent upon us. In terms of how we make that happen within a family, within our household, within the different ages and stages of the children. So it's a very challenging balancing act that we have to run a home that it's got to be well run, it's got to be well controlled. At the same time, giving children responsibilities and rights within our day-to-day living. In other words, if you do everything for your children, you'll have a very well run house. But it's much less likely that you're producing capable, strong adults. And in addition to just the simple, concrete chores within a home, which you should definitely begin handing over to children, there are many things in a child's life where parents could possibly end up making it much less effective in terms of reaching that goal of an independent child. But if something happens, something happens in playgroup or in a playground or in school or in shul, the child faces some kind of adversity or something, they get in trouble, or there's, they're doing poorly academically, and the parent immediately swoops in and tries to make it good. So you'll solve the short-term issue, but what message are you giving to the child for the long run? If mama is always, coming in and saving the day, so the message you're giving to the child is that, I'm not so capable. I need somebody else to save me. Because I can't handle this situation on my own. It must be that I'm just not very capable. So therefore somebody comes to my defense. And that, like I said, this is a balancing, the balancing act. The joke is that in a previous generation, if a parent got a call from school, that the kid was misbehaving, so the kid got walloped. Now if a parent gets gets a call from the school, so they go get a lawyer. So neither one was very accurate, but that is the that's the stereotype. So we have to allow our children to experience natural consequences. Obviously, if we know our child, which we're supposed to know our child very well, so then we're more capable of achieving that balance. You know, and there's many, many examples. You know, a child comes home from school who's got a very difficult, daunting project, or they were given a task of, when they're older, organize some activity. Maybe there's some, the student organization, or they get older, they have different projects involving a lot of moving parts. So, what is if it seems like it's too hard and the child is complaining and they can't do it, so. Is our instinct to, pick up the phone and tell the teacher or the principal, what are you telling me? It's way beyond my kid. What are you giving her to do? Like, it's bound to fail. Or do you encourage him and say, listen, we're going to do the best we can. I trust you. I have confidence in you. You can do it. You'll work hard. If you need my help, ask me. But I don't know which one is correct, but we have to realize that only having one response is not going to be helpful. We have to know our child, and many times people are way more capable of things than they give themselves credit for, we give them credit for. I heard a great quote that if anything is possible, then it's possible to do it. If anything is possible, it's possible to do it. Children can do, we can all do great things. We are probably accomplishing maybe 10 or 20% of what, we could possibly do. There are people who, for whatever reason, good reasons, maybe they're oblivious, they just forge ahead in different things, different areas, projects, community events, community involvement, and they accomplish incredible things that they would not have thought able to do. They have many more abilities than they thought. They were lying dormant. There's yata dishmaya when you try really hard. And will help. So with the child also, we have to try to keep that in mind, that there's, we want them to become independent. That does not negate a warm and loving relationship that will continue to exist throughout your life. But always make sure that just making them not feel under any kind of pressure is not working towards that goal of independence. So going back to this idea, let's say organizing some activity, I guess maybe sort of, maybe an 11-year-old or a 14-year-old, whatever they might be at that point when they're given some kind of a responsibility. So if it seems very daunting, so I think the best way a parent can be supportive is to, okay, let's try. And you know what? We didn't think we would succeed. So if you don't succeed, we didn't really expect you to succeed anyway. So it's not going to be so terrible if it doesn't, if it doesn't go so good. So what have you, what have you lost? We'll try. You never know. You might be successful. And if you're not successful, okay. You don't have, we don't have to go into every venture with the guarantee of success. It's another very important lesson for a child, that if you only go into things that you know for sure you're going to succeed, you're going to be very limited in what you do. And many of us, I think, suffer from that lack, that self-confidence that we can handle a disappointment. And, so part of that comes from how the parent trains the child to view challenges in life. Okay, it's a challenge. Rabbi Pesach Krohn, he spoke about this. He had a formula. I think he said it was... S to the third degree over N. He said, some will, some won't, so what? And the N is next. Meaning that, okay, so not everybody can do things, not everybody will do things, some will, some will try, some won't. But in terms of me, so what? So I should try, and what difference does it make if others won't? And then, and even if I fail, next. I'm moving on to the next thing. So S3 to over N. So that's, we're able to give our children that feeling of confidence and ability to function independently if we make sure that we're not always swooping in and we are, trying to give some thought and encouragement to the child, and they'll be able to do a lot more than you thought and they thought, and it will stand them in good stead for the future. All right, next is responsibility, which is very much tied into being independent. Responsibility is not, I don't think, extensive responsibility is something that a child was born with. It's not part of nature. It's nurture. It's what, how a child is what they experience, what they've grown up. Nobody is born irresponsible. They could become irresponsible. They could become responsible. Parents have a lot of input in that. Responsibilities for a child can be something most that they welcome very much if they see it as it's a privilege, it's a sign that they're growing up. If you ask any child starting at probably age 5, who maybe is struggling a little bit in school, and you say, do you want to repeat your grade or do you want to move ahead? So the child will inevitably say they want to move ahead. And even though it's much harder work, there's bigger responsibilities, there's no child who won't want to, at least they'll think in their mind that they want to handle those greater responsibilities because they see it as a sign of, I'm growing up. So we can harness that same concept in all sorts of responsibilities. If you give children responsibilities in the home as a sign of respect, that now you're capable of doing this, you're a big boy, you're a big girl, and you can whatever the chore might be, starting at a very young age, they will handle them very, very excitedly. They'll be very enthusiastic. But you have to be very clear in terms of how you give over a responsibility. Because you do want to guarantee success. You don't want to make it that it becomes something overwhelming. Many 7-year-olds, they want a pet, and of course they'll take care of it and everything else. And it always ends up with the mother. So you have to know what the level is. You also have to be very clear in terms of what the responsibility is. Because you tell a child now, you're a big boy now, you're responsible to clean up your room. So what does clean up your room mean? They have no idea of what you mean. They'll have their own concept of clean up your room. They'll pick up one dirty sock and move to the other side of the room, and they cleaned up their room. So you have to be very specific. So you'll tell them. Okay, every Sunday and Wednesday, before you go to sleep, you have to make sure all your clothes are in the hamper. And every, Erev Shabbos, you have to put all your toys into, these 3 boxes. And that's what you have to be very specific. But then once you give a responsibility and you explain what the responsibility is, you can, if it's a little bit more sophisticated, you can discuss, how will both the child and the parent evaluate whether they're fulfilling their responsibility properly, and to make it clear what it is that the room should look like, beginning of Shabbos, I walk into the room and I see that there's nothing on the bed, and I see that on the desk there are there's some space visible at least at the top of the desk, whatever it might be. To make it clear, specific, and show it as a sign of respect, and that's it. Don't micromanage. Don't swoop in. If the room ends up being a mess, so after a few weeks, we can say, okay, do you think you have been successful in your task? Are you fulfilling your responsibility? Let's see. We set up certain criteria. Is there anything on the bed? Oh yeah, what happened? Last week's the candy wrapper, whatever it might be. I'm not saying it's okay to eat in your room, but if you're specific, and they'll be able to move to their they'll be able to fulfill their responsibilities. Okay, and you have to let it go. I mean, when it comes to responsibility, and anybody who's been involved in any kind of community project, you know that you can't have two people being responsible for the same job, the same project. It's always one person is responsible. So if you're giving your child a responsibility at home, it's got to be his responsibility. Obviously, you have to think about it beforehand. Can I live with a messy room? Can I live with, you know, smelly laundry, you know, sitting around the room for X number of days? Do I have enough clothes even to let it, whatever, you have to figure it all out. But once you give the responsibility, that's it, it's the child's responsibility. At some point, you know, after passage of time, you can jointly evaluate, but it's the child's responsibility. Don't say, hey, we made an agreement, you know, and, you know, it's already, you know, it's already Monday evening and the place looks like who knows what. If you do that, then you're not teaching them responsibility. You're teaching them that, you know, mommy will always save the day. Okay. All right. Okay, we're going to finish up. Just again, to try to encourage you with the giving responsibility, you have to consider what the worst possible outcome could be. All right, what's going to happen? You're going to have a plate that breaks if the child is in charge of washing them, so you'll have a broken plate. Maybe somebody will get hurt. Okay. You have to decide what the different responsibilities are. What's the worst thing that could happen? Normally, in this situation, what are the worst possible outcomes? And if you can handle it, then you should go. You should go ahead. Okay. Just want to examine to finish. Just, you know, there are children who live in very, very difficult circumstances. Either the parents are not getting along, or there's extreme poverty, or parents are never there. Or Chas v'Shalom, there's a sickness in the family, and there's something that just makes life not flow the way we would like it to. But many of these children come out very emotionally secure, mature, happy. So what is it that that caused that? Why? You would think that, you know, Nebuch, they don't have a normal situation, so how could they turn out normal? I would suggest that it's possible because by having extra responsibilities thrust upon them at an age that maybe we wouldn't have thought would be appropriate, but many times they're stuck. All the stories, you know, a 9-year-old girl, you know, her mother was sick and there was nobody else to run the household. She stepped up and took care of that. Somehow she figured it out and she did it. Obviously, it's possible that the child will become extremely resentful, but I suspect that in more cases than not, the child is learning independence, is learning responsibility, and with obviously emotional support in other areas, it'll turn out to be even more normal, more well-adjusted, and that's because, you know, they had to rise to the occasion, and like we said, there are many dormant capabilities that that children have that we're not, you know, not aware of. And finally, there's a saying, which is certainly have to keep it in mind: if you burden a child with a load that is too heavy, he will break his back. But if you do not give him any load to bear, he will not know what his back is for. If you do not give him any load to bear, he will not know what his back is for. All right, so. Child can only learn how satisfying it is to fulfill a responsibility if you give him responsibility. So it's not just helping you, which is always great if kids can take some of the burden off of you. If that's your approach, you're not going to be teaching them responsibility because you'll be micromanaging, because it's really your responsibility and you're trying to make them your worker. That's not how you teach them independence. It's make it their responsibility. And pleasantly surprised how they can rise to the occasion. Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay. All right. Next week, set on the schedule Tuesday. However, that was for me, and I my situation changed, so I could do Wednesday. Is Wednesday better? Or it doesn't matter? So, I mean, the publicity already went out, so I guess we'll leave it at Tuesday next week? Okay, we'll leave it as is.
Yep.
Okay, so it'll be Tuesday. Okay, take care.
Thank you.